Welcome to a very special presentation of the novel A Really Good Day by James Hosek. On its surface, it's a story about a remarkable round of golf. But if you're not a golfer, if you quickly change the channel, if you accidentally come upon a tournament on TV, I encourage you to listen anyway. It's a story about family and friendship. It's a story about redemption and second chances. It's a story about promises made and promises kept. It's a story about once-in-a-lifetime experiences. But most of all, it is one man's love letter to his family. That man was my brother, the author, James Hosek. Aside from being an amazing veterinarian, woodworker, gardener, husband, father, brother, son, and friend, he was a writer. Writers are often told to write what they know. And in this, his first book, he did that in more ways than I can count. It will make you laugh. It will make you cry. And it will make you stand up and cheer. So sit back and enjoy as Jim takes you on a fun, entertaining journey through 18 holes of golf and one man's really good day. Chapter 4. The second hole. Since Scott had the lowest score on the previous hole, he had earned honors at this one and was the first to tee up. This hole was a par 4. A good drive would get him 140 to 150 yards from the pin. From there, a shot onto the green would position him for a decent chance at par. Par would be acceptable. He knew his limitations, and two birdies in a row was a rare event. Even one over par, or a bogey, would leave his total score even at par for the first two holes, and he'd be in a great position to shoot a personal best. As Scott stepped up to the tee, he noticed a kid holding a pole with a white sign on top. It had places for five golfers' names. Three were listed, followed by two numbers. Hanover was at the top, with a minus one, and a one next to it. Then Spalding with an E for even, and a one, followed by Baldwin with a plus one, and a one. He wished he had a camera to get a picture of that. The first number was their current status with regard to par, and the second, which hole they had just completed. Scott was one under par, and Pete one over. Scott placed his ball near the right gold tee box marker, and stepped back to line up his swing. He would aim a little to the left side of the fairway, since his shots tended to fade, meaning they veered to the right. Even if he hit it straight, he'd still have a playable situation. To the right was a stretch of forest, and he definitely wanted to stay out of there. He drew his imaginary line back from the ball, then lined up his feet parallel to it. The quiet was noticeable, but not distracting. A cool breeze brushed his hands and the smile on his face. He took a practice swing, and the club seemed to pass through a perfect arc, ending up over his left shoulder with the follow-through. A swish through the air emphasized the speed of the club. He stepped forward 4 inches and started to bring the club back again. His wrists bent slightly at the top of his backswing. The memory of his muscles from the practice swing took over, and he swung the club through the ball. It took off with a perfect trajectory. And then he saw it. The end of his club was in the wrong position. He had opened it up, turning it clockwise. The result of his error was quickly apparent, as the ball veered to the right. The spin caused by Scott's twisted club head had taken over from the raw velocity of the shot, ending up with a very significant slice. The ball hit the grass, traveling almost perpendicular to its intended path, and rolled out of sight behind some trees. At best, he was still perhaps 200 to 250 yards from the hole, assuming he could find his ball. Worse yet, the large trees to the right side of the fairway would now provide a difficult obstacle to the green. He stood frozen, his club hanging over his left shoulder, his eyes closed with disappointment, ready to give it all up. Who was he kidding? One good hole, yeah? A par round? In your dreams, bucko. Mr. Spaulding is up, announced the official. Scott looked quickly for his green tee, but it had flown out of sight when he hit the ball, and he left the tee and handed the club to Paul.
I saw where it went. It opens up behind those trees. I think you have a shot, Paul half-whispered.
They stepped back to a safe distance.
Maybe, agreed Scott glumly. Darn, I really didn't want to bogey this hole, Paul.
Just get it on in three and you'll make the up and down, said Paul.
Up and down referred to the neat trick of still being able to finish a hole in par, even though you didn't make it to the green in regulation. That is, the par for the hole minus two strokes for the putts. Jerry's drive was perfect this time, and he was no more than 130 yards from the pin. Pete followed him with a similarly great shot, perhaps 10 yards behind him. Both of them seemed to be shaking off the last hole and moving on. While everyone else moved down the fairway, Scott and Paul trundled off to the right. Paul was correct. The trees did recede back to leave a small meadow of tall grass. After a minute or so of looking, Paul gave a quack, and Scott joined him to study his lie. The ball was visible, but just. A good whack might get him to the fairway, but he'd be lying too, and likely still behind the other golfers. They'd be waiting to hit their second shots while he was hitting his third. Even though a line of trees stood between him and the hole, Scott wondered if he might not have an alternative.
Pop it out with a 7-iron? Suggested Paul.
I'm thinking 7-wood, answered Scott. If I can get it to roll up through the trees, I might be left with just a short chip to get on the green instead of still being 200 yards away.
7-wood won't cut through the grass, Scott. You need to just get it over to the left on the fairway and get a good shot at the green.
I can get it out with the wood. I've done this before.
Okay, conceded Paul. It's your game.
He pulled the large-headed club from the bag and handed it to Scott. Scott lined up a shot and took only half backswings when he practiced. He didn't need to get a lot of distance from the club, just to hit it out of the tall grass into something playable. Each practice swing ended up with the club knocking down a bunch of grass. With little of the confidence that had been with him on the last hole, he smashed at the ball. The tall grass caught the club as he swung, twisting it, and sending the ball off to the right, this time barely getting above the ground. It found the asphalt cart path and rolled a bit before settling on the grass on the far side of the path. He was now behind the line of trees he had hoped to avoid, and nowhere closer to the fairway he needed to be on. He handed the club to Paul, afraid to look at him lest he get the "I told you so" stare.
At least you got out of those weeds, offered Paul, trying to find a positive spin to put on the situation.
Closer to the hole, added Scott, stating the golf model that he had developed on his first time playing. It was his theory that any shot that got you closer to the hole was a good shot, and he was closer to the hole, even though it left them with a tougher lie. He was still further from the hole than the other golfers, and would have to hit his third shot before Spaulding and Baldwin would hit their second. As he approached the ball, he started to grin. He saw a small break in the line of trees, perhaps 15 feet wide, that gave him a straight line to the flag on the green. He'd have to keep the ball low, but if he hit it straight, he could still get on the green in three and have that chance at par.
"Grass burner, please," he asked Paul, referring to his 3-iron.
The club had slightly more loft than his putter. That would keep the shot low over the grass and hopefully out of the tree branches.
"Are you sure?"
"Do ducks quack?" answered Scott.
Paul pulled out the 3-iron from Scott's bag.
"Aim for the tree," joked Paul, hoping to relax his friend.
It was another of Scott's golf theories that one never hit what they aimed for. Therefore, the easiest way to miss hitting a tree was to aim straight for it. Scott chuckled at the comment and seriously considered doing just that. But he had made this shot dozens of times before.
a nice easy backswing with the ball near his back foot, so the club face would hit the ball when it was nearly perpendicular to the ground, keeping it low and out of danger. He took two practice swings, confident he had just the amount of backswing to make it on the green. He stepped up and flawlessly duplicated his practice swings. It took only a fraction of a second for the ball to whack one of the trees to the left and bounce off to the right. Once again, the cart path was there to help his ball roll, this time downhill. He watched as a little white orb followed the path beyond and to the right of the green.
"You didn't aim for the tree," Paul pointed out.
"No, I didn't," agreed Scott. He laughed. "Should have aimed for it."
"Like I told you," said Paul.
The banter was light, and the mood had shifted. They were now just two friends playing the game they both loved, rotten shots and good shots together. Enough good ones to make it worthwhile, and enough bad ones to keep it fun and interesting. Scott handed Paul his 3-iron, and they started off down the path to his ball. Pete was lining up his shot and easily made the green, 10 yards to the right of the pin. Jerry's rolled a little off the back of the green, but both would be in the hole easily in 2 more strokes for pars. If Scott landed his next shot on the green and one-putted, he'd have a 5. 1 over par or a bogey. 2 putts would give him a double bogey, but he would still be only 1 over par, and that was still a good start for him. Scott's ball was on the path next to the grass. The rules allowed him some relief, and after getting a nod from the official, he picked the ball up, walked a yard up, and while holding it at arm's length, he let it fall onto the grass. Paul handed him his pitching wedge. "It slopes to the back and left side of the hole," he advised. Scott nodded and casually stepped up to his ball. The girl from USA Sports had her camera ready again and was just off the back of the green. He hoped he wouldn't hit her. Wouldn't that be great? The clip would definitely show up on a sports blooper reel. He lined up the shot a little to the right of the pin to leave him a slight uphill putt. He took only 1 practice swing this time. An easy, slow backswing, not quite as full as his regular one. He stepped up to the ball and repeated the same stroke. The club picked the ball nicely out of the rough and sent it soaring high into the sky. Scott could see that despite his careful aim, the ball was headed slightly to the left of the pin. Hopefully he might catch some downhill action to roll it closer to the hole. It seemed to stay up forever, and Scott watched the one good shot he'd had this hole. He stood facing the pin, still frozen in his follow-through position, his club hanging over his left shoulder, his weight balanced on his left foot. Paul sensed it almost the moment Scott hit the shot. It was like the ball knew where it wanted to go. With a soft thud, it hit the green just past the fringe and started to roll and roll and roll. Scott's club slipped out of his fingers onto the grass behind him as he watched the ball plink against the flagstick and drop into the hole. He realized he had been holding his breath, and it escaped with a sudden gasp.
"It's in the hole,"
Paul said in a perfect Bill Murray impersonation. Caddyshack had provided a lot of good quotes for golfers, and none was sweeter than, "It's in the hole."
"Yes, it is," said Scott.
Some from the next group of players on the tee joined the applause from the spectators around the green. Without having the ball near the fairway, or even using a putter, Scott had parred the hole. A disaster had turned into a miracle, and now he was still 1 under par. Ellie slowly lowered her camera as she shook her head. She'd never seen anything like it. This guy was either extremely good or extremely lucky, the latter being the most likely. She thought about pulling out her cell phone to get Jason Bernard out here to watch this guy, but realized it wouldn't do any good. He was here to do the least amount of work and get on to his next assignment. Well, she'd keep following him. Maybe this guy would turn into a story. But for now, it sure beat sitting around the clubhouse. Scott picked up his club and handed it to Paul. Together they walked up to the green, and the sight of the ball in the hole made it real. He picked it out and held it tightly in his hand. His grin was huge. He could muff the rest of the shots today, and nothing would take away how he felt now. He would tell the story of this hole for months, even years to come, as a highlight of this amazing day. Jerry Spalding gave him a pat on the back and added, "Good shot," as he walked past. Scott thanked him, and he and Paul took their place with the other caddies as Jerry and Pete finished the hole. They both ended up with pars, but nothing as dramatic as the hole Scott turned in, and they knew it. The official with the walkie-talkie made his report, and the threesome headed for the next hole. Sarah Hanover hauled the tall and wide but relatively thin box out of the front closet, where it had sat for the last 2 months, and pulled it into the living room. She looked at the picture on the front and smiled to herself. In a couple of weeks, the baby pictured in the crib would be theirs. She was so looking forward to it. With a sigh, she remembered why she was doing this by herself today. Scott was out at his golf tournament, and it was likely he and Paul would make a full day of it. Well, if he wasn't going to put this darn thing together, she would. Couldn't be that hard. Sarah never could understand the attraction that golf had for Scott. As far as she could tell, it caused more frustration than anything else. She was always picking up golf magazines that Scott had left lying around. Each one promised to take 10 strokes off your score and eliminate that pesky slice. If they were able to do what they said, then why did they have a different article on the same subject every month? Shouldn't all the golfers be hitting the ball perfectly and having their best score on every round by now? But he seemed to love it nonetheless. Scott and Paul would come back and regale her with stories of missing the hole by an inch or almost nailing a goose with a drive. For those few hours, they had problems unrelated to the rest of their lives that ended after 18 holes and a beer. They could spend all that time together and discuss nothing deeper than the latest golf equipment, little tricks and tips from their magazines, and how beautiful the course was this particular time of year. Perhaps her feelings were related to her own frustration. In a way, she was jealous of his golf time. She had nothing comparable. It seemed whenever she got together with her friends, all they seemed to do was complain about their lives and their kids and their husbands. They never seemed to be able to leave it behind like Scott and Paul could. Men had a different way of interacting with each other, Sarah thought. She pulled open the flaps at the top of the crib box and started to remove the preassembled side sections. The resemblance to a jail cell struck her as she lined each piece up against the sofa. Her baby would be a prisoner for a couple of years. When she was a kid, cribs were much more dangerous than today. The bars were too far apart and the mattresses too soft, and it was too easy for tiny fingers to get caught in the mechanical workings. Yet she and her two sisters had survived those old death traps just fine. Her mother couldn't understand why Sarah wanted to buy a new crib when she had a perfectly good one sitting in the basement that Sarah's father could set up for them in a few minutes. Sarah tried to explain the safety features that the newer cribs had incorporated in the last 30 years, but her mother clicked her tongue in disgust. "It was good enough for you girls. It ought to be good enough for my grandchild," she insisted. Sarah thanked her for the offer and ordered the crib from a website after a few weeks of research. Scott complained about the cost and was almost ready to get her old crib from her parents' basement, but she convinced him it wasn't safe, and she really wanted something better for their baby. He had been promising to set the thing up for over a month now, but one thing after another delayed it, and now it was this stupid tournament. "If only that stupid guy hadn't broken his stupid wrist," she complained to herself. Well, he could have his golf game. She would show him she had the ability to accomplish this task without him. And when he came home tonight and saw the crib in the baby's room, he'd have to be impressed. Oh, he'd shake it and test the assembly a little, but he'd have to give her his approval, and she'd have a little bit of guilt to hold over him for putting the project off for so long that his poor pregnant wife had to do it herself. The instructions were printed in about 16 different languages, and finally she located the tiny square in the huge fold-out sheet that had English printing. It was full of spelling and grammar errors, likely the product of some poorly paid Chinese translator, but she soon had the 20 or so parts sorted out. She took a little break and poured herself a cup of decaffeinated coffee from the pot in the kitchen. She flipped on the television for a moment, and there was live coverage of the Chicago Marathon. Apparently, some unknown runner had taken a large initial lead, but most of the commentators said he lacked the stamina to keep it up, and the well-trained and experienced Kenyans would overtake him soon. Talk about more boring than golf. At least in golf, there were 18 holes. With the marathon, it was 2+ hours of one race that likely would come down to the last few hundred yards anyway. She turned off the television and selected the CD of prenatal songs on her iPod. She set it into the speaker adapter that Scott had gotten her on their last anniversary. The songs were said to train your baby's mind while it was still in the womb. She figured every little bit of help was needed to combat any quirkiness that Scott's genes had inserted into their baby's brain. She grabbed the tools she had rounded up from Scott's workbench and started to assemble the crib. It went together with relative ease, and within 20 minutes, she was rolling the crib back and forth on its casters. She covered the mattress with the pad and Sesame Street sheets she had bought a couple of weeks before. It boggled her mind that sheets, less than a sixth of the size of her own bedsheets, could cost twice as much. This was just one little expense she would keep from Scott. Jubilant in her accomplishment and anticipating the surprise on Scott's face, she wheeled the crib down the hall. The baby's room was across from theirs. She opened the door and started to pull the crib in behind her. She stopped and shook her head in disbelief. She covered her eyes, and soon she was laughing. Sarah Hanover, master carpenter, in her first project for her unborn child, had made a simple yet critical mistake. The crib was wider than the door. A few futile attempts to twist the crib in different angles were made before she was ready to give up. She could just imagine the laughter from Scott if he had been there, and she was laughing with him. Oh well, live and learn. She looked at her belly and told her ripening child, "Don't you go and tell your daddy. This will be our little secret." Maybe Scott would have made the same mistake. She was half tempted to put it back in the box and insist he assemble it himself tonight. The disassembly and reassembly in the baby's room didn't take as long as the first time around. She rolled the crib next to the diaper-changing table and stood back to admire her handiwork. "God," she suddenly thought, "what if it's a boy and, she almost couldn't bring herself to imagine it. What if he liked to golf, too?" A sudden pain in her abdomen startled her. It wasn't as intense as she had been warned labor pains could be, but she wondered if that was what it was. Had she exerted herself too much? The doctor had told her that even though she wasn't due for a couple of weeks, the baby could come at any time. The sensation quickly faded, and it seemed like nothing had changed. "That was interesting," she said to herself. Scott would be home by dinner, and it was unlikely anything would happen before tonight if she really was starting labor. Andrew Patterson's caddy had a white handkerchief out and was wiping the leather of Patterson's bag, working out some invisible stains for the perfectionist owner.
"Hi," said Jake. "You must be Andrew Patterson's caddy."
He held out his right hand.
"Hi,"
answered the boy. He shook the hand, smiled, and quietly resumed his work.
"Tough boss, huh?"
"I suppose."
It was going to be a little harder than he thought.
"I'm Jake Fisher."
"Eric Peters,"
announced the boy without looking up.
"So you think your boss is going to win today?"
"He does,"
Eric answered.
"What do you think?"
"Hey, I'll take any chance I can get to caddy in the big leagues."
"You a golfer?"
asked Jake. changing tack but keeping in mind the boy's last statement.
Who isn't? He answered.
Yeah, I guess so. You think you'll be in this tournament someday?
Maybe. I mostly play so that I can be a better caddy. You know, apply my experience to help the golfer.
Mr. Patterson ain't like most golfers, though.
How's that? Prodded Jake.
He's got every shot already worked out. He gives me a list of what clubs he's going to use on every shot, and I have to give them to him. I don't ever try to give him any advice.
Doesn't he need it?
I've caddied for dozens of golfers. Even Tiger Woods needs some advice from time to time.
But Mr. Patterson doesn't like that.
No, sir. He pays well, and he says if he wins, I'll go with him to the Pro-Am. Once you get to caddy on the Pro Tour, that's where the big bucks come in. Heck, Tiger Woods' caddy made $900,000 one year. Not bad for a bag carrier.
Wow, said Jake in awe.
Yeah. Now, I don't think Mr. Patterson has a chance in the pros, but there is always someone looking for a new caddy. I just got to be in the right place at the right time, is all.
Sounds like a plan, agreed Jake.
You a reporter? Asked Eric. It was the first sign of curiosity he had expressed up to this point.
No, I'm a sports agent.
The reply seemed to be the first thing Jake said that got Eric's attention.
You're looking to sign Mr. Patterson? Asked Eric, with no small degree of incredulity.
I have a company that might be interested in him if he wins, said Jake.
His comment evoked an unexpected response from the caddy. Eric began to laugh.
That's a good one, mister, he managed to say between chuckles.
At this point, Jake, thoroughly confused but intensely curious, waited. He sensed there was more to come. Eric's amusement faded, and he seemed to focus his attention on his duties with Andrew Patterson's clubs. He turned back to Jake.
Have you seen Andrew Patterson yet?
From inside the clubhouse a few minutes ago. I came out to see if I could get a word, but he disappeared. I'd hoped you might know where he was, answered Jake.
He always disappears before a tournament. I have no idea what he does. But if that company wants a winner, well, Mr. Patterson has never lost one yet. Still, I can't imagine seeing him on a TV commercial driving a Buick like Tiger Woods. He just wouldn't fit, you know?
You don't think he'd be good at that, eh?
Well, maybe if you're trying to sell pipe tobacco to pretentious snobs, but I hardly doubt that's a market worth pursuing, added Eric.
Jake's agent instincts automatically made a note of the suggestion. To Eric, it might not seem like a potentially grand idea, but to Jake, that was just the kind of direct connection he used to be able to make. Used to, he reminded himself, before the disaster with Brad Finley. Before he could reclaim that life, he would have to regain the trust of those he had disappointed during the last year. His job today was to get Patterson for Callaway and then move on. It was a way to jumpstart his career and his life.
If you see him, tell him I'm looking for him.
Jake pulled out a business card from inside his sports coat and handed it to the caddy.
Have a good day, Eric.
I'll see you around.
Jake let out a long sigh as he looked around for the bright splash of color that would give a clue as to Patterson's whereabouts. A familiar desire began to fill Jake's thoughts. He glanced at his watch. It hadn't been that long. Surely he could last the day without a drink. Fortunately, there was nothing to tempt him here. This was a forest preserve golf course, and no alcohol was permitted. Still, there was that liquor store he passed on 159th Street, and it was at least an hour or two before Patterson even got to the first tee. He sat on the low stone wall in front of the clubhouse and buried his face in his hands. Was he sweating? Was he beginning to have physical withdrawal symptoms? Or were they entirely psychological? He imagined Gina and took strength from his desire to make things right with her. He was here, after all, and he was trying. He lifted his head and saw a skinny older man walk briskly past him. He was dressed in yellow and red plaid long pants and had a yellow golf shirt on. The ensemble was topped with a yellow cap. He had some cardboard placards and was headed for the large plywood scoreboards. Most of the cards he carried were numbers, but he also carried larger ones with player names on them, presumably for the leaderboard. Jake assumed that the running list of placements in the tournament would change frequently. As with most tournaments, the lowest-ranked players began and were quickly washed off the top 10 as the better players took to the course. Jake stood and walked over to the space in front of the scoreboard and watched the scorekeeper slide a placard labeled Hanover into the first place spot and put a -1 followed by a 2 next to the name. Hanover was 1 under par and had finished the first 2 holes. 5 other names followed, the second in a tie with Hanover, but only after 1 hole. He wondered how long this Hanover guy would last. At least another couple threesomes, he figured. The scores for the individual holes went up, and Jake saw 2 fours go next to Hanover's name. From what Jake knew about golf, if Hanover could keep that kind of scoring up, he might stay in contention. But there must be a reason he was starting in the first group. "Interesting start," commented a man who somewhat startled Jake. He had come up next to him while Jake had been studying the board. His left arm was in a cast and was suspended by a blue sling. He had a beige baseball cap on and wore tan slacks with a red and white striped golf shirt under his tan jacket. The man looked to be about 35 and had a deeply tanned face that was staring enviously at the scoreboard.
"Don't tell me it's a golfing injury," joked Jake.
The man laughed.
"No, carelessness. A log fell on my arm while I was chopping some firewood."
"I assume you're not playing today, just an interested onlooker?"
"You can say that. I'm Joe Culkin."
He held out his right hand.
"Jake Fisher," returned Jake.
They shook. Joe held up his casted arm.
"Cost me a spot in the tournament today," he continued.
"I'm sorry to hear that," Jake said sincerely. "It sounds like the winner is going to have a chance to go pro."
"Well, play in a pro-am tournament. Going pro takes a lot more than 1 win in a regional tournament."
"Did you have a chance?" asked Jake.
"Actually, yes."
"Really?"
"Now it looks like Patterson has the field to himself, unless something unusual happens."
"You think someone could beat him?"
"I got 5,000 reasons to hope someone does."
Jake looked perplexed. Joe explained.
"I bet Patterson $5,000, him against the field, that he'd lose today."
"Regretting that bet, are you?"
realized Jake.
"A little. That arrogant jerk suckered me into it. I doubt the anxiety will affect him any, but it will certainly keep my blood pressure up today."
$5,000 is a lot," commented Jake.
"Well, there are 59 other golfers out there today. One of them may have it in them."
"You know Patterson well?"
"Not really. We played together twice before. He beat me both times. But I had a couple of bad holes. Stupid mistakes. He's a good golfer, but he doesn't know how to play golf."
"Excuse me?"
"He can swing a club and read a green with the best of them. But to him, it's a project, a job, a task. I truly believe he has no fun when he golfs. He's here to win a tournament. Anything less will be a tragic disappointment."
Jake mulled over Culkin's assessment, adding it to Eric's. Neither of them had high regard for Patterson. Should that tell Jake something? Was he headed for disaster with this assignment? Still, he didn't want to let Jonathan down. He was sticking his neck out giving Jake this chance, and he didn't want to blow it. He'd sign the golfer and let Jonathan work out any potential personality conflicts.
"Now, Scott Hanover," mused Culkin.
"Off to an early and doomed lead, eh?"
"Well, based on his scores all year, he's 60th out of 60.
"Not much of a chance to win your bet there, I guess."
"No," agreed Joe.
"But he does play golf, in every sense of the word.
I saw him make a putt that he himself didn't know he could make a couple of weeks ago. No one could have made it unless they just walked up to the ball and said, 'What the heck, I'll give it a shot.'"
"He could come in 60th today and be ecstatic just to have gotten the chance to play."
Sounds like a great guy.
He is. His wife is expecting soon. He mentioned to me that it was unlikely he'd get out to golf after that. Maybe he'll be out here someday with his son or daughter, giving them his gift for enjoyment of the game.
I guess that is the key. You really need to enjoy the game, agreed Jake.
The essential truth of those words grabbed him. He was beginning to believe Patterson wasn't what Jonathan or Callaway had envisioned, but he'd follow his orders. There was time for selectivity when he was fully back in the game. Joe pulled a little disposable camera out of the sleeve of his sling and snapped a quick picture of the leaderboard.
I'm sure Scott wouldn't mind a souvenir of that, he said,
nodding at the neatly displayed board.
Good idea, agreed Jake.
Ellie Burke watched as Scott Hanover retrieved his ball from the hole. He had a genuine expression of disbelief as he looked to make sure it was his ball he was holding. She checked the battery on her camera. It was still at about 75%. With the spare she had in the shoulder bag, she ought to be able to follow him the whole way through the front nine. There were more batteries in the truck she could retrieve at the turn to continue taping, unless that stuffed sports coat, Bernard, wanted to leave after getting his shots of Patterson. She was half tempted to let him take the truck back with whatever Patterson footage they took, and she'd get back to the editing room on her own later. This was what golf was about. Turning a disaster into a par with just one lucky shot. Of course, the luck could turn the other way at any point, but right now, she had that amazing shot on tape. Hopefully, she'd be able to get Bernard to work it into his report. She watched as the other two golfers putted out but didn't tape their shots. They were good players, but this was a relatively short par four, and a good player should par it. Scott Hanover was not as good as these guys. That much you could tell from his first three shots on this hole. But for some reason, he was playing better than he usually did. That much you could tell from his expression. She seemed certain Hanover was going to have a good day and decided to make sure he'd get a copy of whatever she was able to tape of his round. She watched as the scorecard holder made the changes updating the standings so far. Two of the players from the following threesome were added, one right under Hanover, with a birdie as well on the first hole. A buzzing from her hip distracted her attention. It was her phone vibrating. She looked at the caller ID, and it read, USA Remote 12. That was Jason Bernard's phone for the day. She pulled it out and stayed back as the rest of the group headed for the third tee. She pressed the send button. Hello, she answered.
Where are you?
Asked Bernard. Just getting some tape of the first group. A guy just sank a chip shot from 75 yards away, she answered softly. She wasn't sure the officials would allow cell phone use during play, so she wanted to be as unobtrusive as possible. That was why she had set it to vibrate mode in the first place.
Amazing, I'm sure. I just need to know you'll be here to get some shots of this Patterson guy when he tees off.
She glanced at her watch. That won't be for at least an hour and a half, she answered.
Just be here. I want to tape a little interview, too. Just a few questions. I can't wait to get out of here.
Don't worry, assured Ellie. She pressed end before she could hear any more whining from the talent. Most reporters Ellie enjoyed working with. They were excited about the events they were covering and would jump at the chance to highlight the unexpected. Most clips that showed up on blooper reels were camera operators keeping the camera running when they didn't need to. She could envision a short spot featuring Hanover's four shots on this hole as a quick example of a golfing alchemist turning lead into gold. The group was on the third tee already, and Hanover was getting ready to make his tee shot. She pulled the scorecard she had grabbed from the clubhouse and jogged up to them. She looked at the layout of the hole on the map illustrated on the back of the card. It was a par three next to a small pond, the shortest hole on the course, she noted. These could also be the most challenging. Andrew Patterson was standing on the cart path leading away from the 18th green. The path twisted through the woods a bit, effectively hiding him from the view of anyone around the clubhouse. The path was paved in asphalt, and imprints from the golf cart tires crisscrossed the surface. The thought of golfers using a cart to play the game made him shudder. If one was going to play this game, they should do it right, he thought. It was just recently that the PGA had prevented that one golfer from using a cart on the tour. Walking made stamina a part of the overall challenge to the round. You didn't have to be in great shape, but one should be able to walk 7,200 yards in 4 or 5 hours without dropping from a coronary. Visiting the last green was a ritual Andrew had started with his first tournament 1.5 years ago. Not even his caddy knew he did it. It was a private moment, and one that he would remember as he teed off on the final hole in 5 or 6 hours. He saw himself standing on the tee, a crowd of anxious spectators waiting to see him finish with another win to his credit. Some might think him odd or eccentric, but he didn't let that bother him. He was playing against the best amateurs, less one, in the Chicago area. They were the ones who needed to be impressed with his ability. Probably all of them had been playing longer than he had, and some were certainly jealous. He would par this hole, but left room for a birdie attempt. The tee shot would have to be just the right distance. Too far would put him in one of the bunkers to the far left side of the left-turning dogleg that surrounded the large water hazard on the course. He would tee off with his 5-wood and place the ball 225 yards out, then follow up with the same club to get him safely on the green in 2. Even if he was just off the green, 2 shots to get in the hole was a conservative estimate. He wasn't interested in making a mistake and turning the score into a bogey. He pulled his pipe from the pouch hanging from his belt. He was here to relax, to prepare himself mentally for what lay ahead. That was truly one of his strengths. He had seen many players let a bad shot affect their game and literally self-destruct. Andrew would never let that happen. He dipped the bowl of his pipe into the pouch of Dunhill Durber tobacco and tamped it down just right with his thumb. He retrieved a stick match, stooped down, and struck it against the cart path. The flare of the sulfur burned bright for a moment, then settled into an orange flame as he slowly stood up. He lit the pipe, taking short puffs to draw the smoke into his mouth, and then exhaled, blowing out the match. He didn't smoke his pipe often, and when he did, it was in private, like now. The aroma of the burning tobacco hung in the still air of the protected woody area around the green. He wondered if the scent would still be there when he returned. After relaxing there for 45 minutes or so, he'd find Eric and warm up a little at the driving range before heading off on his round. He looked forward to collecting his $5,000 from Culkin at the end of the day. Joe had been reluctant to make the bet. It would take some sort of miracle for someone to beat him today. Andrew didn't believe in miracles.
Thank you for listening to A Really Good Day, a novel by James Hosek, narrated by Rich Hosek. If you are interested in purchasing a hardcover edition of this story for yourself or a golfer in your life, visit jimbooks.myshopify.com. You'll get free shipping in the United States. You'll also get the complete audiobook and ebook editions with your purchase. And make sure to subscribe to the mailing list for updates about the upcoming release of his Doctor at Mystery series, Cozy Mysteries about a Crime-Solving Veterinarian. Thanks again, and all the very best.